Good morning. May it please the court, Catherine Haidt appearing on behalf of appellants SG Interest 1, SG Interest 7, and Margan Investments. The instant dispute involves the interpretation of a contract, which harkens to the familiar dialogue between Alice and Humpty Dumpty. When I use a word, Humpty Dumpty said in a rather scornful tone to Alice, it means just what I choose it to mean, neither more nor less. The question is, said Alice, excuse me, whether you can make words mean so many different things. The question is, said Humpty Dumpty, which is to be the master, that is all. The first issue in this case is whether a pipeline participation agreement is clear and unambiguous and reasonably reflects the party's intent. Fundamentally, the contract documents are Exhibit L, the AMIA, or Area of Mutual Interest Agreement, paragraph 5, which is quoted at length in our brief, our opening brief, and Exhibit G1, the August 7th, 2006 letter agreement fully executed by the parties by which GEC agreed to participate in a pipeline.
Ms. Haidt, may I ask, just as a preliminary matter, so that I can better understand the posture of this case. As I understand the record and the arguments, there are certain facilities that the parties agree are not subject to the injunction. And is there a way that I can discern from the record exactly which facilities are subject to that mutual understanding?
The only facilities that are at issue in this case are the Bull Mountain Pipeline and the Divide Creek Treatment Facility, which we've jointly referred to in our briefs as the facilities. And I believe that the trial court specifically made that finding at, I want to say, paragraph 15 of its facts. And those are the only two facilities. There are numerous other facilities that these parties co-own. Five oil and gas wells that SG operates for the benefit of both parties, a natural gas pipeline that GEC operates for the benefit of both parties, a well that GEC operates for the benefit of both parties. So when you look at that injunction and it says all common facilities, what I just referenced are all common facilities in Gunnison County alone.
Right. Okay. Now, if I may, I'd like to ask a second question.
Sure.
And you can perhaps deal with it during the course of your argument. As I understand it, after this agreement was struck, the parties at some point entered into various negotiations about who should be the operator.
Well, I would clarify it this way. I think that for several years, the parties discussed an LLC agreement pursuant to which SG would operate the facilities. And that discussion changed in April 2011 when GEC said, no, let's do a joint venture and we'll have a third party operator. So this is shortly before the lawsuit was filed.
Isn't that some indication that this agreement, in fact, doesn't specify who the operator should be?
We submit that the agreement does not specify who the operator shall be. It is a participation agreement. It's a financial agreement.
Okay. Now, if that's so, why does that make it ambiguous?
Well, we submit it's unambiguous if you interpret it our way.
I understand that.
But the trial court refused to even consider the fact that participation included a financial participation. So it just rule that the contract means, or excuse me, that the participation clause means what it says without ever defining for the parties what it says. What could the possible meaning be if the court was interpreting it as an equal rights provision, which it is not?
So what do we do with the language that the parties agree that the other parties shall have the option to participate in the planning, permitting, construction, operation, and ownership of each of the pipelines?
Well, our construction, Your Honor, is that all those gerunds or those modifying phrases reflect certain cost segments of the whole project. So you have planning, you have permitting, you have operations, you have ownership, et cetera. And those all represent cost segments. You can't equally participate in all of those things. There is no way.
But isn't that a narrow meaning of participation?
I think it's the only reasonable meaning, Your Honor, because there's no way to otherwise evaluate how someone can participate in a financial arrangement, which is basically what this is, Your Honor.
Wasn't it contemplated that there would be another agreement that would really spell that out, or perhaps have a third party be the operator?
There never was an agreement by SG that there should be a third party operator. Never. There was discussion about putting together a formal written operating agreement, but under the law and under the contract documents, a formal written operating agreement is not required. So both parties testified at trial that that participation clause envisioned that each party would be the operator of its own pipeline. For GEC, the Sheep Pipeline, for SG, the Bull Mountain Pipeline. I believe GEC then altered the plan in April 2011 when it said, let's do a joint venture, let's do a partnership. Well, certainly under joint venture and partnership law, the issue of control is very important. But the parties have forever disclaimed that they are a joint venture or a partnership, even though sometimes they use those terms kind of indiscriminately. All their contract documents evidence that they had no intention of creating a joint venture or a partnership until April 2011, when that proposal was made by Bill Koch and GEC.
Pardon me for interrupting, sure. If I may, please. I want you to help me with something here.
I'm happy to.
Thank you. I appreciate it. My concern is that I see your argument as being contrary to the general rule that we must construe the terms in a contract based on their ordinary meaning. I'll give you one example of my concern that has to do with the way that your brief defines the term basis, which it refers to in a tax context. There's no indication in the document, other than your argument in the brief, that they intended to use that rather specific term of art to define the word basis. And if we look at the standard definition of that word, i.e. footing, and we look at the word before that, equal, it appears to me that the ordinary meaning of the words is contrary to the way that you would interpret them. Now help me understand why my position is wrong here.
Well, I believe, Your Honor, you can't look at basis or equal or unpromoted without the context of the participation language itself. And it talks about equal and unpromoted basis. Now, when you look at equal and unpromoted basis, what that signals is, because it modifies basis, what that signals is that there's a quantifiable measure as to ownership and as to cost. And that's why equal and unpromoted basis is that entire phrase. It doesn't say on an equal or unpromoted basis, and it doesn't just say equal basis. Those terms trigger the financial consideration. I would note that participate itself is now deemed as sort of an archaic term in the dictionary and is usually considered to mean something very specific under the circumstances, and we submit that under the circumstances, it means financial participation. If we were talking about a partnership, if we were talking about a joint venture, which we are not, we would be talking about co-control. But we're not talking about that. We are talking about an interest in a pipeline, a tool that's used by the parties in their competitive businesses. Remember that. These are competitors. So when they want to jointly own this tool, it doesn't mean that whereas this is where we are today, that GEC has the right to shut down SG's business, which is essentially what it's done. The last 18 months, SG has not been able to proceed with its business plan. It has not been able to proceed with production from its wells because that pipeline is shut down. GEC wants co-control. Well, we submit, and we submitted in the trial court, from day one on December 11th, that as two people cannot co-control or drive a vehicle, you cannot co-control or drive a pipeline. One party has to do it. And the assumption was GEC would operate its pipeline, the Sheep Pipeline. SG would operate its pipeline, the Bull Mountain Pipeline.
But again, if I may interrupt, please.
Yes.
That may, as a factual matter, in this particular case be true, because it's pretty clear from a look at the record that the parties are at loggerheads. But then, unfortunately, though, that may not be the outcome that they envisioned when they drafted the language. And don't we have to look at what the words mean, as opposed to the fact that there's not a lot of cooperation now?
I think you do have to look at what the words mean. I think if you look at that participation clause in AMIA paragraph 5, and then look at the acceptance of that option by GEC, which is that exhibit G1, which is attached to our opening brief, it's very clear that GEC anticipated paying costs for half the ownership of the pipeline, for half the capacity of the pipeline. None of those documents suggest that GEC will thereby gain some sort of co-control or co-management or co-operatorship rights in the pipeline. Those words aren't found anywhere in those contract documents. Your Honor, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time, if I might.
All right, Ms. Haidt, you have about three and three quarters minutes.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Tim Beyer. My bar number is 12168, and I'm here on behalf of the Appalachian Edison Energy Corporation. SG's objective has been to claim ambiguity where there is none. First in the Area Mutual Interest Agreement, and now on appeal in the Court's injunction. The AMIA gave both parties the right to participate in the operation of the Bull Mountain Pipeline on an equal basis. SG tried to arrogate to itself the unilateral operations, and the trial court entered a preliminary injunction on the basis of the clear language of the contract. Gunnison then moved for summary judgment based on that finding, but the trial court denied the motion for summary judgment and held a trial to take extrinsic evidence about the custom and usage and the course of conduct between the parties. The trial court found that SG's evidence did nothing to alter the unambiguous meaning of the clear contract language, that Gunnison's rights are equal to SG's in every respect, and SG cannot assume operation without Gunnison's consent. Now, SG challenged the trial court's order and judgment on really two grounds. First, it says that the relevant language in the contract is ambiguous, or maybe they say that it's unambiguous to be read the opposite of the way that the trial court did it. There are three reasons why this court should affirm the finding with respect to the meaning of the contract. First relates to the standard of review. The standard of review is clear error if the court looks at anything other than the plain language of the contract. The trial court took extrinsic evidence of custom and usage and the party's course of dealing and assessed that evidence and the credibility of the witnesses through whom the evidence was admitted in determining what the language means.
Well, we can determine if the contract is ambiguous de novo, can we?
Yes. If you were to look only at the plain language itself in determining whether or not there's an ambiguity, that is a de novo review.
Mr. Beyer, just incidentally, don't agreements like this normally designate an operator?
No. Operating agreements typically designate an operator and define the rights and obligations of all of the parties. This is an area of mutual interest agreement, and it relates to two pipelines, neither one of which existed at the time, so there was nothing to operate yet. Each party had a pipeline project in mind that it was at the beginning stages of developing, and the question was which of these pipelines is going to go forward, and the point of paragraph 5 of the AMIA was to give both parties an option to, if they decided to do so, to drop one of the pipelines and go in together as equal partners on the other pipeline. In 2 years later, Gunnison exercised its option and the decision was made to go forward with the Bull Mountain Pipeline rather than the Sheep Pipeline. But as the evidence that the trial court took made clear, Gunnison put language in that paragraph 5 to give it these rights that Judge Kopelke read concerning the right to participate in the planning, permitting, construction, operation, and ownership on an equal and unpromoted basis. And SG didn't reject that language. What they did is they made it reciprocal to make sure that whichever way it went, both parties had those equal rights. Now, the second reason that the court should affirm is because the language uses ordinary words in their ordinary usage and in a way that is clear as a bell. Grammatically, in the testimony of trial from SG's expert, Professor Martin, was that grammatically, the language that we just went through can be abbreviated to say that each party has the option to participate in the operation of the pipeline on an equal basis. If you take out the other parts of the conjunctions that are contained in that clause, that's what it says. Equal has a universally understood meaning such that neither party has a right superior to the other. SG's case was a trial and still is on appeal, nothing more than a tortured interpretation of a very straightforward clause. The third reason why this court should affirm is that the extrinsic evidence of context, custom in the industry, usage, the party's course of conduct was presented over 10 days of hearing, including 4 days of trial, and the court reached its decision based on the evidence. The appeal is really nothing more than a rehashing of the evidence that was presented and rejected at trial. SG's briefs are replete with references to evidence that it presented at trial. There's no question that SG presented hundreds of exhibits and days of testimony from lay and expert witnesses in support of its interpretation. But the trial court heard and rejected that evidence, and not even SG can claim that there's no evidence at all in the record to support Gunnison's interpretation of the contract. SG offers nothing new and nothing that was not countered by Gunnison's evidence, and there's no reason to find clear error in the court's findings or conclusions relating to the evidence that it took to determine what the meaning of the contract was. Now, with respect to the injunction and what SG, the second argument that SG basically makes is that the injunction was vague or was overbroad. And again, SG is trying to create ambiguity where there is none. First, it says that the injunction applies to a specific pipeline called the Bull Mountain Gathering System, a facility that is not a common facility at all, as undisputed by the parties. It is owned 100% by SG. It is not a common facility. It doesn't fall within the meaning of the contract in any way. Next, SG complains about the trial court's description of the word common facilities as being vague, even though that is precisely the term that the parties used in the contract. This is not a term that the court came up with and has some vague and undecipherable meaning. This is the language of the contract specifically, and as counsel stated, the parties agreed that the only issue in the appeal with respect to what was a common facility or not was whether the Divide Creek Treatment Facility was a common facility. That there was evidence on both sides of that, and the trial court made a specific determination that it was.
Mr. Beyer,
yes.
Does the injunction here impact SG's gathering system that connects to the Bull Mountain Pipeline?
It does not. And the reason is because, as I say, it's not a common facility, and therefore is outside the scope of the injunction. The third objection that SG raised in its briefs to the injunction is that they say that it restricts their right to alienation. It prohibits them from selling their property interests. Nothing could be further from the truth. The order says that SG, quote, may not transfer operation, management, or control of the common facilities without plaintiff's consent, end quote. There is no reference anywhere in the order to the word interest. The word interest or property interest appears nowhere in the order of judgment. The reason this came up is that SG threatened to not only sell its 50% interest, but along with it, the sole rights of operatorship. That's what precipitated the filing of the motion for a preliminary injunction back in 2011. And started this case was when they threatened to do that. The trial court was aware of the distinction between selling their rights and selling their interests and selling these sole operator rights that they didn't have, and that's why the language in the order is what it is. They have the right to sell what they own. They don't have the right to sell to somebody else, potentially who might claim to be a BFP. They don't have the right to sell to that to anybody, the sole rights to manage, control, or operate these facilities, because they don't have those rights. Finally, SG argues that the injunction required the parties affirmatively to enter into an operating agreement, referring to a clause in the conclusions of law. The trial court was merely recognizing in the conclusions of law section that if the parties are to operate these joint facilities, if they're going to do it, they're going to need to enter into an operating agreement. The court heard evidence that that's the custom, the universal custom in the industry, is to have an operating agreement if you're going to operate something, and in that to identify the operator and to identify what the rights and obligations of the parties are. But the reference is nowhere. The reference to this acknowledgement that the parties are going to need to have an operating agreement if they're going to go forward and operate this together, that's not in the order and judgment. There's nothing in the order and judgment at all that relates in any way to the parties agreeing or not agreeing to enter into an operating agreement. Now, I want to address for a moment.
Pardon me, counsel, if I may interrupt.
Yes, sir.
Out of curiosity, how is this going to go? Let's assume that we agree with you, hypothetically, that we agree with you and we affirm. How's this going to go? Is this going to get resolved? And what's the next step?
Well, there are parties in the courtroom today who are in the process of negotiating documents to resolve all of these issues, and hopefully they'll get there. But I don't have a crystal ball, and I don't have the ability to effect that outcome. But the short answer to your question, Judge Bernard, is that either the parties are going to reach an agreement of some kind or another, or they're not. And they're big boys, and they'll agree or they won't agree. And if they don't agree, then nothing will happen. And if they do agree, then it'll be whatever they agree to.
Okay.
So I wanted to address for a moment the issue of what it means to participate. Now, to participate is a verb. It's an active verb. It's the infinitive form of the verb. It's not a noun. The court heard evidence actually on that specific point. And the terms that follow are the objects of the verb: planning, permitting, construction, operation, and ownership. SG never presented this argument of its that participate can only refer to a financial interest until July of 2012, halfway through the case, when their expert witness filed an affidavit asserting that position. And there are references that we gave in the record to the testimony of Mr. Gwynn from SG, confirming that SG had never made any statement like that to Gunnison at any time, that that's what the word participate was intended in the contract to mean. The trial court took conflicting evidence from the experts on what to participate means in the context of that clause, and rejected SG's experts expressly, discredited SG's experts, and credited Gunnison's experts and agreed with them. So specific evidence was taken, findings were made, conclusions were entered with respect to the issue of what participate means. And what it means is what it appears to mean on its face, which is to say that the parties get to engage in each of those activities, which the testimony at trial was were intended to encompass everything that relates to a pipeline and the associated treatment facilities. Soup to nuts, cradle to grave, are those five terms, and that's what they're intended to denote, is everything that is to be done. And it says everything is to be done, each party gets to participate in, and they get to do it on an equal basis. I also wanted to address briefly the equal and unpromoted basis question and what that means. We took the position that equal means equal, and the court agreed. And the court agreed that it can't be read any other way. The rights are not equal if one has control and the other does not. The term basis is not used in this agreement. It was never understood in this agreement to be a tax term. If you were to ask, if one of your honors were to ask me, on what basis, Mr. Byer, do you make that argument? if I were to respond to you by saying, I take it you mean that in terms of what my tax basis is, you would probably look at me like I was crazy. Of course, that's not what it means, and it's clearly on its face not what is meant in this agreement. SG took the position that equal and unpromoted mean the same thing because it's only relating to cost issues. And I just point out to the court that paragraph 5, if it had intended to convey only a cost issue, it could have said the parties each will have the right to participate in the cost of participating, permitting, planning, construction, operation, and ownership on an equal basis, but it didn't say that. And unless the court has other questions for me, that concludes my argument.
Thank you, Mr. Barr. Ms. Haight?
Thank you. At the outset, I note that Mr. Byer's reference to a settlement, this agreement in the wings is at best unreliable. These parties have been talking since 2007 about how to end this dispute, and they have not been able to do so. I would also, in response to your earlier question, Judge Bernard, the co-owned assets at issue are at paragraph 6, page 3 of the judgment, the two, the pipeline and the Divide Creek Treatment Facility. Mr. Byers has said several things that really are not supported by the record. For example, equal and unpromoted basis are different things. What we have persistently argued is that equal refers to the quantum of ownership. What are you buying? You buying 50% of the pipeline? Unpromoted refers to what's your cost. And because in the oil and gas business, it's frequently provided that if you're a participation, if you're a participant in that project, you may well pay more than 50% of the cost. You may pay 60% of the cost instead of just 50% for a 50% interest. So it's quantum of ownership, quantum of cost. What is it to you?
Isn't that a rather esoteric view of what promotion means? I mean, I think I understand what promotion means, but I understand it in the context of the plain meaning of the language. I don't understand it necessarily from this record in the context of tax law or anything else.
Tax law was an example. Promoted, as we refer to it as, if you look at the Hoover case that we've cited, it describes what participation in an oil and gas project means if it's promoted or unpromoted. It recognizes that if you're a participant on an unpromoted basis, you have much, it's much more favorable to you as a participant than if you were participating on a promoted basis. Because a promote gives the project originator basically extra gravy for taking the risk in bringing the project to the table. And in this case, we said we'll do it. You can have up to 50% of ownership in the pipeline, and you can pay 50% of the cost and no more.
But that extra gravy is never specified in this contract.
There wasn't any. But by saying it's unpromoted, it was there will be no gravy, essentially. I hope I cleared that up. The other thing that I wanted to point the court to is the Sheik Pipeline. When GEC asked SG if it wanted to participate in the Sheik Pipeline, it talked about it in terms of financial participation. It didn't talk about it in terms of co-control, cooperation, or anything like that. And GEC indeed said, you have a right but not an obligation to participate in our pipeline up to 50%. What do you want to do? Again, later on in 2007, they said, you have a right to participate in the in GEC's SG pipeline. What blank participation interest do you want?
Ms. Haight,
yeah.
If I might ask you something, do you agree with Mr. Byers' statement that the applicable standard of review, to the extent we determine that the agreement is ambiguous, would be a clearly erroneous standard because the court took evidence and made specific findings, rejecting some testimony and accepting other?
May I answer?
Certainly.
I don't agree. I mean, I agree with the standard. If the court is to make the determination that it's that it can, it requires consideration of extrinsic evidence, then the issue is going to be clear and unambiguous, right? The trial court did not...
Clearly erroneous, you mean?
Yes. The trial court did not consider extrinsic evidence for the purpose of determining the party's intent or for the purpose of determining whether the contract was clear and unambiguous. In the court's judgment, at paragraph... I don't have it right here. The trial court's judgment, though, makes clear that the only consideration it gave extrinsic evidence was whether there was an estoppel or waiver. It didn't consider whether all the statements that we found in GEC's files indicating to third parties that it had no interest in managing or operating the Bull Mountain Pipeline should be considered in determining GEC's intent when it entered into the agreement. Court never considered that. But we submit, Your Honor, that the court can look to the four corners of the agreement, which the trial court never did. The four corners of the agreement being the AMIA paragraph 5, exhibit G1, and that we submit within the four corners can establish an unambiguous agreement only if you find it means a financial participation.
Thank you, Ms. Head.
Thank you.
Thank you again, Mr. Beyer. Thanks to both counsel for your arguments today. I think they were helpful to us. The matter is deemed submitted, and you can expect a written opinion to issue in due course.